Thanks very much, Dave, for agreeing to do this interview.
Mm-hmm. No problem at all. Just for the record, I'm just saying this because I notice sometimes there's some confusion. Some people call me Dave, and if I write something, it says Dave. Say, was that the same Dave that is also called David? So officially, what my mother named me, or maybe it was my father, is David Austin. But most people familiar with me call me Dave. So yeah, just to avoid confusion down the road. Yeah.
David or Dave?
Either one is good.
Yeah. Maybe you could tell us, maybe just introduce yourself, say a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what your interest is in politics at Concordia.
Again, David Austin. I'm one of the founders of the Alfie Roberts Institute, which is where we're meeting currently. I don't know. I guess who's been involved in community issues for the last, it's 1994 now, the last 14 years or so here in Montreal. First as a student, as one of the coordinators for the Black Students Network, the Southern Africa Committee during the days of apartheid. And I guess also through radio and through writing. That's about it, I would say, in a nutshell. In terms of my connection to Concordia and Concordia politics, I guess there are many ways to respond to that question. One is that when I came here to Montreal, I came here to go to university. I came here December 1990 and met a number of mostly students from McGill and Concordia University who had formed a group called AKX, also known as X. And the group was very active in terms of dealing with questions of police brutality. There had been several shootings of black youth or young adults here in the city in the late 80s and early 90s. they were at the forefront in terms of responding publicly to these shootings and racism within the police force, violent racism in the police force. And it spilled over into a number of other things. They'd organized public forums, weekly public discussions, what they called rap sessions. And I sort of got involved, I would say peripherally, by and large, because the group had been formed probably 88 or 89. I came later. And I started to attend their meetings and so on. And the following year, because I started university here in January of 1991, so by September of 91, as a coordinator of the Black Students Network at McGill, we would organize some of the events conjointly, bringing in speakers or whatever the case may be. So it's through that we sort of developed a link with other students at Concordia, many of whom lived in the city, so they weren't like many of the students that come from that attended at the time McGill, particularly the black students who came from abroad or from the United States. And then a bit more specifically, it was through those meetings that I met somebody named Alfie Roberts, who this institute is named after. And somebody I could say had a profound influence on a number of people. You know, you could even say two generations of people, myself being one of them. Through his work, his political community work, his writing, his thinking, his intellect, in a number of different ways. He was, I wouldn't say involved in AKX, it was primarily young people, students primarily. But he sort of, how would I put it? I mean, I think many of the people involved in AKX would have seen him as a mentor, somebody they could always turn to. And I actually met him at an event at Concordia where he was speaking during one of the rap sessions. And I could say it's the beginning of a long friendship. And I don't mean that necessarily in terms of years, but I do mean that in terms of you know, a relationship through which I think I benefited a tremendous amount. In terms of understanding, you know, the issue of social change and in an attempting to understand the world that we live in better also. And it was through Alfie, again, to be even more specific in terms of relationship to Concordia, that I began to discover how important Montreal as a city had been is historically, in terms of political developments, whether you look at it in terms of the union labor movement here, in terms of the nationalist movement and what that meant as a political movement beyond the question of, well, in addition to, and in some respects beyond the question of sovereignty. And in terms of what it meant in terms of the, what it meant as far as developments within the black, Canada's black population, Montreal's black community, and developments particularly in the Caribbean, where Alfie and a number of other people, Franklin Harvey, Tim Hector, Ann Cools at the time, Robert Hill, very active in a group called the Caribbean Conference Committee, which was struck pretty much in 1965. They also went on, in addition to developments here in Montreal, which we'll talk about. I mean, to me, you can't separate those developments from what happened at Sir George in 1969. But in addition to that, went on to do important, significant things in different parts of the Caribbean and also here in Montreal. So it's through Alfie, primarily, that I began to understand the importance of developments here in Montreal and the context in which those developments unfolded. I had heard, as a high school student in Toronto, we used to meet at what was Third World Bookstore, run by Mr. Lenny Johnson, Lenny as we called him, and his wife Gwendolyn Johnson. The bookstore is no longer there. But we used to meet there regularly and have discussions and so on and read books, discuss them. There's always like free-flowing discussion. And it was there that I actually bought a copy of Let the Niggers Burn, a book by Dennis Forsyth, who wrote about the Sir George Williams incident. So this was back in high school that I had put my hands on that book, my own copy. But prior to that, maybe it was my brother, my older brother, who had encouraged me to read that book, and I took it out to the public library in Scarborough, Agincourt, and read it. So I always sort of had a certain kind of image of, you know, the place that Montreal had, but it was kind of superficial. Moving here, getting, you know, making contact with Alfie and being actively involved here myself sort of brought me closer to that in many respects. So I feel in some respects it's a tradition that I you know, in a very general sense that I inherited. Yeah, so that's my long answer to your initial question. Yeah.
Could you maybe speak a little bit about student struggles at Concordia in the late 60s and early 70s? Because for many Concordia activists, that has always been a point of reference. Mm-hmm. However misunderstood or unclear mm-hmm. that was, there was always the knowledge that Concordia, mm-hmm. then known as Sir George Williams University, was famous for the most expensive mm-hmm. Riot in Canadian yeah. university history.
I'm taking my shoes off so I can be comfortable, because this becomes a bit of a long story, I think. I think what people have done is they sort of isolated the Sir George Williams incident, or, you know, the Sir George riots, and taken it out of the context in which it happened. And in order to talk about Sir George, you have to talk about a whole series of events, a confluence of events, and also events that precipitated Sir George, and also what Sir George meant in the post-Sir George Williams affair period. Because I suspect that, and this is how close this thing comes in terms of understanding Canadian history, I suspect that Canada's multicultural policy, and I've never heard anybody talk about this, doesn't mean that nobody has, but I've never heard anybody make reference to this, that Canada's multicultural policy came about as a result of Sir George. I suspect it did, because Pierre Trudeau is from Montreal. Before becoming Prime Minister, he was very familiar with, and many people that would be involved in Sir George were familiar with Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Rosie Douglas knew him quite well. In fact, there's a rumor, which is neither here nor there, that Rosie stole his girlfriend. And I don't know what to make of that and what bearing that has on his case later down the road. But there is that rumor. It's a rumor, so I'm not spreading rumors. I'm just sort of iterating what I once heard. So he was very close to these events. And, you know, even though the Sir George Williams incident and what happened to the students in terms of their prison sentences was eclipsed by the October crisis the following year, you can't but help think that it must have impacted, you know, Trudeau as an individual, the Liberal Party, his government, because it certainly influenced the rest of Canada in terms of people thought about racism, because people did not think that there was such a thing called racism, or were in denial, I should say. Because if you're... it's hard for... Black people obviously knew that racism was a fact of life historically, going back to the days of slavery here in Quebec. But there was a general myth that was shared by people in Canada that racism did not exist here. And what Sir George Williams did was bring it to the fore. And then, as usual with things like this in any government sector, after a major event, it's just like going back to Caribbean history where there'd be major rebellions, there's always a commission of some kind or another. It's part of the Commonwealth tradition. So I don't know what kind of, and it would be interesting to investigate, what kind of commission or reports or studies that came out, whole entire Sir George Williams. But you can be sure there was something, and that it influenced the policy, Canadians' policies and Canada's policy in terms of race relations in some form or another. So going back in terms of talking about who these individuals were, who were some of whom would end up being involved in the Sir George Williams incident, it's important also to talk about the context in which black people came to Canada, specifically, and the reasons why they came here. Many of the students attending Sir George and McGill University came here because Caribbean students, particularly from the West Indies, meaning the English-speaking Caribbean, former British colonies, well, many of them were actually British, many of them were actually British colonies still at this time, were being discouraged from going to England to study. Britain's immigration policy and the sort of general political climate in England, in Britain, in England in particular, had changed. And the presence of black people who had been encouraged, West Indians, who had been encouraged to come to England, in particular after the Second World War, to rebuild the post-war England, were now becoming a problem to politicians and to the wider British public. They were no longer welcome. So Canada became the next logical place, part of the British Commonwealth, English-speaking, major institutions, particularly universities. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of West Indian students began to come here. And Montreal was a logical place because Montreal was really the major city in Canada at the time, not Toronto. People knew of McGill. Many people probably didn't know of U of T. Just part of the whole West Indian tradition and so on in terms of how people think. They think of the major universities. But then not everybody can get into the major university. And Sir George had what you could call a relatively open-door policy. It was supposed to be a people's university. So people gravitated to both Sir George and McGill, usually for for the same reasons, but different kinds. The brightest of the bright, so to speak, in theory, would go to McGill, or at least make an effort to go to McGill because of the reputation and all of this thing, which is not a reflection on what kind of education they did or didn't get. And many of the other students came to Sir George. And it's worth noting that it's not that these students were necessarily were encouraged with open arms to come to study here, but the immigration policies at the time were permissible. you know, well, there was a certain degree of openness, which obviously Sir George was a manifestation of this. That began to change as the numbers grew. But when they came here, there was also there were a number of things happening. First, there was a long-standing black community, so-called indigenous black Canadians, many of ocean origin, who had been here for many years. And the conditions that many of them found themselves living under were often impoverished or not too high above the poverty line, or working in sort of service jobs, hoteliers, porters on the trains, servants to a certain extent, in the kind of service industry, but the low end of the service industry. It was very rare to find a black Canadian, as they were described, in a university setting. Many black folks live below the tracks in what is Little Burgundy, St. Henry, Point St. Charles, in that general area, extending almost towards Old Montreal, where the Molson, or what is it called now? They changed the name. Where the Montreal Canadiens play. I think Bell Canada owns the building now. So there was a thriving jazz scene. Folks living in Little Burgundy, interesting, many, a number of people owned their homes. It wasn't a black community in the sense it was only black people living there, but there was a large core of black folks that lived in that general vicinity. And organizations like the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Marcus Garvey's organization, was quite active. The Colored Women's Club was also quite active, and these are organizations that were formed around the turn of the century, so they go back that far. The Negro Community Center, also very active, as well as people involved in the Union United Church. So these were institutions that were thriving in a climate of hostility, pretty much, and where black people expected to know their place. So there were institutions, and people didn't come here and find nothing. They came here and found thriving institutions. In fact, an argument could be made that they thrived as a result of the racism that did exist here. Black folks could not, and generally did not, venture into certain parts of the city, certain clubs and certain restaurants. They were pretty much, it was understood that they weren't for black people. Even great jazz musicians that would come here and play, because Montreal was an important circuit in the jazz scene, would play and leave through the back door the same way they entered. You know, that was the situation here. But also to add in terms of like the institutions and organizations, an individual passed away about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, Henry Langdon, got involved in the Universal Negro Improvement Association probably in about 1924 when he was about 12 years old. His father was involved in the organization, so he was a Garveyite from a child. He passed away as president of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Now, why is he significant? In addition to his own perseverance and the work that he did over a long period of time, is that his father, if I'm getting it correct, was the uncle of Louise Langdon, who is the mother of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X's mother came here to Montreal from Grenada, active in that area, Little Burgundy, Point St. Charles, as a member of the UNIA. And Yang Karu, a Guyanese author, has gone as far to say that she played a very pivotal role in what would later become, laying the foundation for what would later become black power in North America. So this is just to give you a sense that even just in terms of the black population, there were things happening. It wasn't a stagnant community. Also, when these coming from the Caribbean arrived here, depending on when they came, because some came mid-late 50s, a large number of students came early 60s, early to mid-60s. The Quiet Revolution was happening. So as Alfie described it, when he came here, there were bombs going off in people's letterboxes. Know, the FLQ were making their statement. So, you know, they arrived in this kind of nationalist climate here in Quebec, where people of the FLQ, like Pierre Valley, theoreticians of the FLQ, were influenced by people like Frantz Fanon and his Wretched of the Earth. also somewhat influenced by development in Africa and other nationalist developments, where some, you know, one may argue quite derisively, was suggesting, well, if Guinea could be independent, so can we. Referring to Sékou Touré taking an independent stance in relation to France. Some of the other countries chose to be part of France's, what do they call it? I can't remember the term for it, but there's a specific term that they had for French, department of France. So that was also part of the climate. The civil rights movement was in many respects at its peak, even though by the time of Sir George, black power was pretty much supplanting the civil rights period. But for many of these students coming here, it was in the midst of all this effervescence across North America. There were all of these developments internationally in terms of liberation struggles, as we were talking about, towards the later 60s, like Zimbabwe and other places. South Africa was on the minds of people. And again, people were looking to Ghana as a model at the time of an African independent state. These students were coming from countries and won their independence. You're talking about the Caribbean. So there was a different sort of mindset, particularly for those coming from the West Indies here, compared to those who were here who had other traditions that were equally as important, that were different. And I'm not sort of suggesting that one is more important or can be valued more than the other, because to be able to survive in an environment that is hostile, where it's sort of acknowledged that you're considered second class, it requires special skills and a special kind of perseverance. But these students coming with a kind of nationalist further throughout the Caribbean and nationalist movements in other parts of the world were not willing to accept, beyond a certain point, many of them, you know, any form of discrimination. They were used to seeing, you know, their, you know, West heads of state who were of their culture, way of life, and so on. So it was an exception to see teachers, you know, university professors and so on who were black from the Caribbean. So, you know, it was not considered a big deal to come to a university and, you know, and then go beyond university and become a doctor or professor or whatever the case may be. Whereas in this situation here, under the climate of hostility, you know, that would not be the norm. Very few universities, and you were considered an exception, and therefore you sort of expected to know your place in other ways too. But these students coming from the Caribbean basically shattered that kind of mythology, and you know, created a climate of their own in many ways. One other thing I would say before describing who these students were is to talk about the student climate in Montreal, throughout North America. If we were to go back and look at the Montreal Star, the Montreal Gazette, and if we were to go back and look at the Georgian, which was one of the newspapers at Concordia at the time, and the McGill Daily, reading the headlines and the articles, you would think that the world was going to change tomorrow. But it gives us some insight into the mindset of people that were active during the time. It's like, you know, they were to arrive from Mars and read this thing. They think, well, this world is just in a state, constant state of upheaval. But that's the world that many people were living in. And I'm saying many people were living in because you can't just say that was the world as it was, because you realize that some people lived through the 60s and it passed them by. You know, they were just going about their lives. So it didn't affect everybody the same way. But, you know, you read through the old newspapers, you see so many things. There's, you know, the Cuban Revolution and its aftermath. You know, nationalist developments throughout Africa and Asia. You know, you'll see a report of Che's disappearance and then Che's death, for example. Then there's the Cold War. Then later there's Zimbabwe. And you know, South Africa was constantly in the press. But then you're also hearing about student upheavals all over the world, across Canada. You know, we hear about Concordia, you hear about McGill, you might hear about one or two universities. But I'm saying across Canada, you know, Brock University, this, you know, you'll find that students were in a state of upheaval. protests, demonstrations, occupations. This is what was happening. Taking over student newspapers. I mean, this was almost like a way of life in the 60s. So I'm saying that to say that what the students did at St. George, you know, and I don't want to separate it from the wider student developments completely, but it was almost like the black complement of what was happening elsewhere. But then obviously you had developments in terms of black students across North America too that were part of but also separate from wider student developments, but obviously part of the same climate and obviously influenced that climate too. So these guys came here within the midst of that, but then with this mentality that, you know, they're not second class or second to anybody, they sort of acted accordingly, students. And now we're talking about people like Alfie Roberts, Robert Hill, Rosie Douglas, Franklin Harvey, and Cools, Tim Hector, who actually was a student in Nova Scotia, in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, but would spend his summers here, his holidays here, and was very much involved in this, in the group that they founded called the Caribbean Conference Committee. Some have called it the Conference Committee on West Indian Affairs. So it's gone by these two names. Now, but even that doesn't, you know, there were other students that came in from the West Indies that were very active too. There was a group that was part of the New World movement. I don't know if you've ever heard of New World, but New World was, you know, it kind of pretty much came out of the University of West Indies setting, mostly professional economists and that kind of political science base, but, you know, political economy was the big thing of the time. And many leading intellectuals like Lloyd Best and James Millett, both right, were very much involved in this thing. So Clary Bain at Concordia University, who was then probably still a student, early, mid-60s, and I'm not even sure if he was still a student while he was a professor at Concordia during the Sir George Williams thing, but he was part of this New World development. You know, they had a journal called New World, which was actually quite good. I mean, it wasn't by any respects a conservative body, but it was more of a kind of professional intellectual grouping. As I said, I mean, a lot of their writing was on economics and, you know, political economy and that kind of thing. But Montreal was a very active place for New World. They had certain centers, you know, in the Caribbean at both the St. Augustine and Mona campus in Trinidad and Jamaica. They had an active following in England, probably in the United States. I don't know so much about the following, but in Montreal it was quite strong because Bess also used to teach, and he may have been the director at one point of the Center for Developmental Area Studies, which is Developing Area Studies, which is part of McGill University. And Carrie Levitt, a well-known economist who was very, you know, much of her research is on the Caribbean, was also involved, was a director at one point of the Center for Developing Area Studies. So through them, there was this strong connection with the Caribbean. People like Walter Rodney later would come through, and all kinds of people, Caribbean issues. That group was here too, but there was something very specific about these students. They were, as has been described, they were kindred spirits, openly and consciously thinking about social change. Not afraid to venture beyond the like conventional, you know, parameters that sort of constrain people's thinking about what possibilities there may be for change. They prayed to engage in the study of Marxist theory, which obviously had a strong influence on many of them. It's reflected in the kind of work that they did, the people that they brought out here. First, George Lamming, one of the, you know, the great intellectuals of the Caribbean, novelist, but more than a novelist and a writer. He's, you know, he's quite the thinker in terms of his analysis of world events and social change. He was the first person as a keynote speaker that they brought to the 1965 Congress, which I think was held at University of Montreal, entitled The Shaping of the West Indies, something along those lines. But something they also all had in common was that, many of them anyway, was that they were familiar with and very interested in the work of C.L.R. James. Alfie had followed James, and independently, Alfie had followed James's developments in Trinidad, where he was a student at Queen's Royal College, the same university that James went to. That James went to. He happened to be in Trinidad, even though he's from St. Vincent, because as a young cricket player, one of the youngest actually to ever play Test cricket Indies, he had been basically recruited and sent to Queen's Royal College so he could be in Trinidad to develop his cricket skills. So he was in Trinidad 55, 56, around there, when Eric Williams came to power, came to rise, and as premier and eventually as prime minister of Trinidad. And James came to Trinidad around 58, so even though by about 58 or so Alfie had gone back to St. Vincent, was no longer playing Test cricket, he was following very closely developments in Trinidad, so was following James's work quite closely. Robert Hill had actually gone to England from Jamaica to study law. He comes up from a family, a long line of people who have been very active in Jamaican politics. His uncle had been expelled as one of the four H's. Richard Hart, Ken Hill, Frank Hill, and the other one, Henry, remember the first name, as being communists, from the People's National Party, under the leadership of Michael Manley. So Robert Hill comes from that kind of tradition of people. His father was an impresario in Jamaica, responsible for bringing people like Paul Robeson, Muhammad Ali, and jazz musicians to Jamaica. So while a student and sort of dissatisfied with his law studies, he stumbled upon some other West Indian students, people like Norman Gervin, I think, Orlando Patterson. And they were part of a study group with James, and he joined the study group. By then, he'd already decided that he was not going to be a barrister, and he left England and came to Ottawa, actually, to study. Wanted to be a historian, study history, but had to do some qualifying courses at Carleton before he could attend University of Toronto. So while in Ottawa, he and his cousin, Anthony Hill, made the trek to Montreal and began to explore, because Montreal, again, was the major city, and it was only a couple of hours away from Ottawa, began to explore the idea of organizing a series of conferences and meetings and so on. And that's where they came and met people like Alfie Roberts, Rosie Douglas, Franklin Harvey, Ann Cools. There was a person that was the head of the Jamaican Association at the time. It may have been called Jamaica House, named Ivanhoe Morrison. But he wasn't so much in the same tradition, but he was one of the people that they approached early. And it's under those circumstances that they met. Rosie, as Alfie used to describe, was a busybody here in Montreal, knew everybody, had contacts with all kinds of people in and outside the West Indian community. So he played an important role in terms of making early connections. Franklin Harvey was an engineer by profession, coming out of the University of West Indies, was studying urban planning at McGill. But he had come into contact with James's work. I think he may have even met James in Trinidad while he was a student, and began to read a lot of James's writing, as well works that would have influenced James, like Capital and other writings. And so he came to Montreal with that. Tim Hector, the details of how he came into contact with James are a bit sketchier in my head, but from what I remember him saying when I spoke with him, he knew of James long before he came to Montreal and had actually probably read the Black Jacobins. He may have even won the Black Jacobins as a prize for some literary competition in secondary school. So they knew of James. But more than knowing of him, because many people knew of him, they were sort of attuned to James's thinking, and there was some kind of affinity there.
Could you just maybe clarify what that was in James's thinking that they were attracted to, and what was important or inspiring about James's political thought? I mean, there's a lot, but mm-hmm. if they're specific that they were attracted to.
I think James's organization of self-activity, self-organization, the idea that people had the capacity to bring about change, you know, James has even been accused of being an anarchist, and his colleagues or associates in the Trotskyist movement, some of them used to call him, kind of missed him as a kind of mystic, because he's always had this kind of free-flowing notion of change, which, you know, I don't know how else to put it, that basically that the evolution of people under capitalism had developed to the point where the tools and the means existed in society for people, and the infrastructure was there for people to sort of, I mean, the best example I think that James would have used later in his life was what happened in Poland under Solidarity, is that workers could assume control of society and administer the state through this kind of, you know, without this kind of overreaching bureaucracy overhanging there, and that genuine democracy could come out of the leadership, not democracy where it's like one person, one vote, and you elect somebody every year, but that through their own self-organization, people would develop the infrastructure to you know, out of which bodies of people could administer and run the state, but not the state up here, but in a more organic sense. That doesn't sound as good to sound, but it's the best way I can put it right now, I think.
What is there about James's thought that specifically was speaking to these young Caribbean students? Are there parts of Black Jacobins that would have been important to them?
I would say the Black Jacobins, yes. Primarily because the Black Jacobins is about the Caribbean as much as it is about Africa, and vice versa, in the sense that the book is about how bands of slaves, you know, organized under the leadership of Toussaint Louverture. But that's what, I mean, this is as James tells the story. I think in hindsight, people have written, and James himself has acknowledged that the story is more complicated than in terms of the layers of the story, but fought and won their independence by defeating the major powers of the time. And James, in writing about how the slave rebellion took place, really informs our understanding of the dynamics of social change and the exigencies of social change. It's really a treatise on social change, on revolution, as much as it is about the Haitian Revolution. But then he was presaging the African independence movement. So, you know, their kind of affinity for James, you know, there were layers to it. James was considered, you know, one of the chief architects of the Pan-African movement, associated with George Padmore, and then many of the leading figures that would go on to help their countries win independence in Africa, and Nkrumah, Jomo Kenyatta, and so on. So on that basis alone, he was considered a very important person, you know, and a history going back to the 30s of being active, in fact going back to the 20s and 30s in terms of writing and being involved in Trinidad, even though James himself didn't consider himself political at the time. When you look back at it, he was obviously thinking a certain way, even going back to the 1920s, early 1930s. So on that level, they saw him as an important figure. Also, as somebody who had returned to the Caribbean in the late 1950s, had been pushed for federation, and the federation collapsed, and Trinidad became independent, Jamaica became independent, and other countries subsequently. But he was also seen now as one of the architects of federation and the possibilities that held to, which is another reason why people saw him as important, as and why these students would seem important. Many of them, some of them may have become familiar initially through reading about him in the paper and his remarks in the paper, and the things that James would have to say in terms of his critique of why federation failed, critique of some of the leaders, particularly in party politics in the West Indies, where you were there, you know, quite a scathing critique of Eric Williams, and in a kind of embryonic form, I would say, because it's not elaborated there so much as it is in some of his lectures, where he talks about the Russian Revolution and so on. You know, but in embryonic form outlines his notion of a political party. And James's notion of a political party was basically one in which, yes, your objective is ultimately to have power, but the process through which that political party, comprised of diverse elements of the society, you know, so workers, the unemployed, you know, I don't want to divide people up into sectors because people are many things, but just for the sake of clarity, women, a cross-section of sectors are involved in this party. And in the process of being actively involved in whatever form, they develop the tools and means to actually become active political beings. So, like, the party, as Lenin also described it, becomes, you know, and as Lenin also described, unions almost become schools. You know, so people are preparing to assume power, because it's always this question of, okay, you assume power, okay, which is what happened with many political parties in the world. What do you do? What's the basis of your power? Is it an election every year, but you don't know what to do with the population? More importantly, the population is not actively engaged in politics. You know, they're expected to vote and then do what they're told. There is no process through which, you know, the population really influences the government's policies. So if the government is here and the population is outside of the government, outside of any process. But James's notion of a political party was an active, organic body where people engaged in politics, in the administration. I mean, and not just like that, but they acquired the skills along the way to become more actively engaged in the political process. That I know will to members in the group, because it's also part of the work that people like Franklin Harvey and also Robert Hill, to a certain extent, as a member of a bang in Jamaica, is part of the work that they would also attempt to carry out, you know, influenced by James's notion of political party and getting a wide cross-section of the population involved. That definitely would have influenced them. Now, I know also, I think it was in 1966, because Robert Hill, I don't know if you know this, but he was also part of Facing Reality, an active member. It's one of the reasons why he was also persecuted in the States for about 10 years. He could not leave the United States, or else he would not be able to come back. I think even one of his parents, mother or father, passed away and he couldn't leave.
Do you want to just clarify what Facing Reality was?
Facing Reality was, it evolved out of the Johnson Forest Tendency, which is a group that James, Rydania Skaya, Grace Lee Boggs, particularly James and Rydania Skaya in the early days, founded within Socialist Workers' Party initially, and then the Workers' Party. It moved from one to the other, and then back to the Socialist Workers' Party, and then eventually it became an independent body. Martin Glaberman, I have to mention Marty also, was very actively involved in that group. And over a period of about 15 years, you can say, give or take, to about 13 in terms of the core period of, they produced a lot of theoretical works that helped, you know, redefine people's notion of Marxism. Made an effort to, as James put it, Americanize Bolshevism. And had an important role as a small group, it wasn't a huge public mass organization, influenced the thinking of many of the leading Marxists in the United States through their writing. But more importantly, they worked very hard to have an organic relationship to workers. And a real relationship with workers, which is, I'm saying that in the sense I'm trying to say, beyond union, who they, depending on the union, would have described as, particularly the AFL-CIO, as as having a blocking or stifling effect on workers' aims and aspirations. And the group was quite attractive to a number of people, students, intellectuals. Carolyn Thick, who's a professor at Concordia University, associated with the group and was quite influenced by the group and by James. In fact, it was actually James that encouraged her to work on her thesis, which is about the Haitian Revolution. But it's a kind of reading of the Haitian Revolution from below. But I think she, you know, the approach that she takes, it adds to what James wrote in The Black Jacobins, but focusing on the popular dimension and less on the leaders and the role that maroon groupings and the average women and men played in the resistance, rebellion, and ultimately the revolution. So it had an influence on a number of people. But by the time James was expelled in 1953 from the United States, Raya Danievskaya was the leader of the group for a while, and then Marty Glaberman, who recently passed away. The group sort of waxed and waned a little bit, and eventually was dissolved somewhere in the 60s. I don't remember the exact date. So when Bobby Hill came to Ottawa and then was sort of back and forth between Ottawa and Montreal and Toronto and Montreal, and I guess especially when he was, by the time he got to Toronto, he created, you know, he was closely, not even closely linked, he was an active member of the Johnson Forest tendency, of what was the Johnson Forest, what was Facing Reality. And it was through Bobby that Notes on Dialectics, James's book on, you know, Hegel's dialectic and its application to revolution in our time, and, you know, it's Notes on Dialectics, Hegel, Marx, and Lenin, that's the modern title of it, where he basically, you know, outlines his theoretical to Marxism and argues that the conventional political party, as we understand it, its days are numbered, and that a genuine party will be comprised of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people, similar to what happened with Solidarity. And in many respects, James would say that Solidarity vindicated his ideas, which, of course, were looked upon with scorn probably by Violet at the time. But also, James, and the book was written in 1948, but Robert Hill is the one that it was written as a series of essays, letters to members of the Johnson Forest tendency, so very few people saw it. But Robert Hill is the one that worked actively to get it published. In Notes on Dialectics, James also gets beyond Trotsky, as he would put it, and Trotsky's notion of the Soviet Union as a degenerated worker state, and reiterates something that he and Grace Lee Boggs and others and Raya Danievskaya had written in a State Capitalism and World Revolution, that basically the Soviet Union was a state capitalist society where all of the contradictions of capitalism obtained, but under the jurisdiction of the state as opposed to the free enterprise system with the parliamentary or necessarily just Westminster, but also the American form of democracy. So that is outlined in Notes on Dialectics quite clearly too. But then James' notion of the self-organization or the self-activity of workers and this new form of political party coming out of that kind of organization, that was outlined crystally clear in Dialectics. So I'm saying all that to say that you asked me about who the Facing Reality was, but that book was published by Facing Reality as a result of Bobby's work, which came out of his work in the Caribbean Conference Committee. And that work would have had an impact on members of the Caribbean Conference Committee, and specifically Alfie, Robert Hill, Franklin Harvey. I'm saying those four specifically, and Anne Cools perhaps to a certain extent, but she was living in England at some point. And Rosie, the busybody, as Alfie described him, was always involved in many things. So the impression that I sort of inherited is that despite his active involvement, he was also involved in many other things. And when it came to sitting down and really studying, because they had a study group. They started a C.L.R. James study circle, and had some very intimate discussions with James on the Russian Revolution, on many of Marx's works like the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, and on Capital, on Caribbean and African politics, on King Lear. I think that some of these were public lectures, but there were also some smaller ones where he was literally speaking to four or five people. It was those four in particular that were actively involved in most of those discussions. Even three of them in particular, Harvey, Hector, and Alfie, because at some point Bobby was a bit more removed in Toronto. So James's political work in the Caribbean would have had an influence on them. His kind of, you know, assessment of his work and his perspective on Caribbean politics as he was leaving in I guess it would have been 62, in party politics in the West Indies. They may have had their hands on Modern Politics, which was a series of lectures he gave in Trinidad, which were subsequently confiscated by Eric Williams and locked up in some fort somewhere. The joke is that Eric Williams also banned his own book, Capitalism and Slavery. I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, in his sort of fits of paranoia. But eventually those books were released and sold to University Book Place, a very important bookstore in New York, which I don't think is no longer, I don't think is there any longer. They may have sold their books to New York University, I think that's what I heard. But I used to visit that place when I used to go back and forth to Toronto very often in the early 90s. A very dusty, unsafe place where there was a not-so-healthy-looking fella that smoked chains. I remember being in the store and sort of watching him as I'm looking through the papers, concerned that this fella would drop his cigarette and set the whole place on fire. But they had copies of Modern Politics, which I know through Facing Reality, members of the group would have got their hands on eventually. In fact, I know that for a fact that they did. So, you know, it's James the individual and what he symbolized, his praxis, meaning his political work, his writing, his theoretical thinking, and so on, reading some of his works that were now circulating in print, and then also much later, because your initial question was, well, you know, what would have drawn them to James initially. But then obviously after that, coming to contact with him, it was all of these things that had a tremendous influence on the core members of this group, and influence what they themselves will go on to do here in Montreal and in the Caribbean.
The thing that we often hear, at least as student activists that were active at Concordia here, in terms of what happened at Sir George Williams and what led to the Sir George Williams affair, was that it was related to Caribbean students in the classroom being discriminated against by a specific teacher who was giving them lower marks, and then that they were grieving these processes and trying to get a response from the university on the question of what they saw as a pretty clear instance of racism. And what I'm wondering is, was this indeed the issue that sort of kick-started off the anti-racist activism at Sir George? And if so, or if not, how do we get from a situation with revolutionary intellectuals committed to revolutionary upheaval, working at a very high political level, reading Hegel and discussing the Russian Revolution and looking through C.L.R. James, how do they relate their thought and their political activity to this instance of racism in the classroom, or something that doesn't quite seem to be on the same political level? All too often we have intellectuals that seem more interested in the books that they're studying as opposed to the very specific cases of oppression.
I appreciate your subtle way of suggesting I show the relationship between everything that we just discussed in Sir George. And it's subtle and not so subtle, because Rosie Douglas was very much involved in the Sir George Williams thing, politically, and he said as much when he came here in, what was that, 2000. I guess it was 2000, that, you know, C.L.R. James, Alfie Roberts, and other members of the group had a profound influence on him in terms of his thinking and understanding of politics. You know, I mean, his basic understanding of Pulse was more in terms of race. But like these folks sort of helped round his understanding of politics in terms of race and class and the dynamics and confluence between these two forces, as well as other form developments and forms of discrimination. Ann Coulls, as I said, was very much involved in the conference committee too. Now, these are two of the chief individuals in terms of those that assumed leadership roles in the Sir George Williams incident and went to prison. But the direct connection between the conference committee and the series of events that precipitated Sir George are 65, they organized a conference with Lamming, and 66, James was here. For the two of them, in 65 and then in 66, 67, they organized not just these conferences where other people, other West Indian intellectuals and people actively involved in Caribbean politics came and participated as speakers with panels and so on in the conferences. So James and Lamming were guest speakers, but there were other involved. It began to create a climate here in Montreal. And, you know, you tie it to all the other developments that we talked about, also the work of New World. Montreal began to be seen as a haven, you know, as a haven for political thinking on the Caribbean, similar to how England was that kind of, you know, haven and helped nurture the political thinking and other people that went on to be very active, involved in the pre-independence movement in the Caribbean and African politics also. So Montreal assumed that role in the 1960s that England had assumed in the 1930s, and also to a certain extent in between those periods. So a climate began to be created here, influenced by all these other things, the labor movement here also. There was a kind of, you know, give and take, a symbiotic relationship between the two. So even after the group disbanded, pretty much in 1967, the core members of the group, with the exception of Alfie, were no longer here. Tim Hector was back in Antigua. Franklin Harvey was in Trinidad and would later go back to Grenada, but this is in the 70s. Robert Hill was back in Jamaica. They were out there doing their thing. And many other people had come to Montreal, it being the sort of magnet for Caribbean intellectuals and politicals and so on, and began to get actively involved. So kinds of things going on. And there's something I have to remember to mention about domestic workers before I forget when I come back to that. So getting involved in, you know, organizing conferences, forums, you know, public meetings, and, you know, so this was the kind of environment, newspapers and things being put up. And the conference committee had talked about organizing a conference in the Caribbean. So the 68 actually is supposed to be in the Caribbean. And they were looking towards Guyana, but because of political developments in Guyana and the nature of the leadership, you know, even though they had an initial meeting with Burnham, they had decided against having the meeting in Guyana because they didn't think it could be an independent meeting, you know, divorced from governmental interference, state interference. So after that, pretty much the organization fizzled out and people went. Still part of this generic, you could say, but no longer the conference committee, but still committed to the ideals of the committee and still very much in touch. Other people got involved, and in the absence of a conference in the Caribbean, they decided to organize the Congress of Black Writers with a more of a kind of black power emphasis. So it wasn't necessarily the politics of James in terms of understanding class dynamics and social change within that context, but also evolving an understanding of race dynamics too. Black power, you know, and Stokely Carmichael, you know, very much considered the leader of the black power movement and the architect of the black movement. That may not be literally true in the absolute sense of the word, but he was definitely its symbolic leader, and was actually even called by many by the prime minister of the black nation, as, you know, some referred to him. He was one of the symbols that they were attracted to, this new group of people. So in organizing the Congress of Black Writers, they brought Stokely Carmichael. They brought Harry Edwards, who led the power protests in the 1968 Olympics, which happened just after the Congress of October, you know, where the black athletes held their fists in the air with black gloves on. James Forman, one of the key figures in SNCC and associated with the Black Panther Party. Walter Rodney, who was then a young historian who had experience teaching in Tanzania, was now teaching at the University of West Indies in Jamaica and was organizing these grounding sessions. You know, where they would have these reasoning sessions throughout Jamaica, but particularly in Kingston, in the most depressed and impoverished areas. A number of Rastafarians participated in these meetings, and a movement was unfolding. And it began to concern the authorities in Jamaica, particularly since Walter had a history of being very active and involved as a student in Jamaica, had gone to Cuba and the Soviet Union as a student, as part of the student society, the student guild. So these folks came, along with James, now considered a sort of mentor, you know, and being looked upon, you know, slowly but surely looked upon as like this elder statesman among black folks in general, not just these radical group of West Indians that they might be described. And then Richard Moore, also a communist, but who would also give a lot of lectures on African history, and was also one of the founders of the African Black Brotherhood in the United States, a very important group that many of their members were part of the formative years of the U.S. Communist Party, actually. And the two groups sort of merged because they became part of the Communist Party, but they became sort of a black section, sort of, within the Communist Party, but not really. Also here, too. A very different kind of communist or Marxist, when you compare him to James, coming out of a very different tradition. But Moore was originally from Barbados. So he, on the one hand, would lecture on African history, but then, you know, he also had, you know, but unlike James, whose notion of history was very much in sort of, you know, even if he was talking about African history or, say, the Haitian Revolution, the two things were sort of blended and intertwined. They were, you know, it's part of an organic development. Moore was kind of here on the one side, and, you know, I don't think he had the same kind of flexible thinking as James, but, you know, that's another story. All these folks came for the Congress of Black Writers. Stokely Carmichael came here. His partner at the time was Marion Makeba, you know, a very well-known South African singer. One of the important figures in the anti-apartheid struggle in terms of an international spokesperson. All these people were here in Montreal. And, you know, it's like, why Montreal? Montreal, this happening, that happening, and, you know. In some respects, probably this conference couldn't have happened in the United States, given the climate. And even if it had happened, would have not had the same impact. You know, things have a tendency to get smothered in the United States. So these folks organized this Congress, which really galvanized black people. You know, now it's an extension of the conference before. It's also a culmination, and more so than the previous conferences, building on the previous conferences, brought all kinds of people out, again within the context of black power. Martin Luther King had been killed that same year, so it was almost like, you know, which symbolized like the end of civil rights or the evolution of civil rights into the black power movement. And
This conference is at Sir George Williams.
It was at McGill University.
Or McGill.
But again, the integration between the two universities, you know, it did not exist in the minds of those who were organizing these events, because the people that kind of went to and fro. So Rosie was a student at McGill, was actively involved in the Sir George Williams thing. Even though on paper it sounds like students organized this thing, it was actually a community event, funded primarily through the institution. But it was not necessarily students. In fact, many people, a large number, not students, organized this conference. There's a whole list of people that had different roles in organizing this thing, and many, many of them weren't students. But it was held on the university campus, and the resources of the university was used. This thing, I mean, it was reported on CBC National Radio. It was all over the papers, the Star and the Gazette. You know, Stokely Carmichael came, and, you know, comparisons between Rodney and Carmichael and James, and like, this was played out in the student newspapers, but also in the wider public. On the radio, public radio, and so on. Not public radio, commercial radio. So it really created a buzz. Those students of Sir George University who had complained about a professor discriminating against them in a classroom were also among those who helped organize the conference, some of them. But then, having participated in the conference, you know, their complaint having been dropped, pretty much all neglected, dismissed by the administration of Sir George Williams University. They couldn't help but feel inspired to take up their complaint again, you know, given the contents of this Congress and the proceedings of the Congress and things that people had to say. They couldn't help but take up their, you know, so that's when pretty much, and they had a hemispheric conference the following month, I think the late October, early November, where many people like anti-Vietnam, it was like a peace conference. J.D. Jagan was here. Bobby Seale was here. This was an international conference again held in Montreal, where, you know, American, you know, American foreign policy, American domestic policy, the whole question of imperialism, anti-colonial, all these things were raised at this forum. So these things combined to sort of influence these students to take up this and pursue it, and not to accept the fact that it had been dismissed without a proper hearing. And that's basically, you know, to make the direct link between these activities and what the students actually ended up doing in terms of filing their complaint leading up to their occupation and so on. That's the kind of, you know, I don't want to speak about it in teleological terms, that's basically the chronology in terms of how things unfolded. And, yeah, we can get into the rest of it in terms of how.
Dave Austin interview on May 14th. So Dave, you've put into context the everything up until the point where the students are taking up their complaint against the professor. And can you maybe explain some of the specifics in terms of what they were complaining about and how that complaint process unfolded?
Okay. One thing I just want to say very quickly is that in addition to students that organized the Congress and that were involved in St. George, there were a number, there were two strains of people that came here from the Caribbean in large numbers. There were people that came here to study, and there were those that came under the Canadian domestic scheme, which is very similar to the scheme that they have for domestics coming from the Philippines right now, where they would come, work in somebody's home, in TMR or in Westmount or someplace here in Montreal, and they were obliged to do that for 1 year. Then after that, they were free to apply for permanent residency status. And so many of them were actually, may have been professionals back home or in whatever kind of job or field, came here through the domestic scheme in order to get status here and, you know, pursue their education. Or some ended up staying here. Many ended up staying. Some went back home. So there were all kinds of people who became part of this Caribbean mix that were involved in these events. You know, I mentioned the core members of the conference committee. But I mean that in a very political sense of the word. I don't mean in terms of those who are just part of your organization. Because in terms of doing things organizationally, planning the conferences, planning meetings and so on, there were a number of women that were actively, in fact, in many respects, you could say there wouldn't be no conference committee without them. Because ideas are one thing, which is not to say that those, the core members, were not organizationally inclined. But the women played a very pivotal role. People like Jean Depardin, Gloria Simmons, who was a secretary for the group for a while, Bridget Joseph. Ann Cools was more part of the core committee too, so I'm sort of taking it out of that, this other group, so to speak, if you want to make that separation. But these women played a very, very, very important role. And two other names I should mention are Hugh O'Neill and Alvin Johnson as founders of the conference committee. And it's important to mention their name because after the first conference, you don't hear anything more about them. And that's primary, well, it's basically because they were killed in a car accident after the first conference, returning some artwork, I think it was, that they had borrowed from a store for part of an exhibit. So it's very important to sort of mention that and put them in their proper place as important members of those developments too. In terms of, there's one thing I should say. You know, I'll use the word evolve, for lack of a better word, in terms of my understanding of what happened at St. George. And it sort of shifted from the exact details and the significance of the exact details in the developments at St. George. And I've been more concerned recently about like the dynamics that contributed to what happened to St. George, the broader dynamics, and you know, underlying developments that contributed to what ultimately happened to Sir George Williams. So, outside of some of the people who I've met personally and know were actively involved as initial complainants, people like Alan Brown and Kennedy Frederick, otherwise known as Omar Wally, and you know, and there are others, you know, I couldn't give you almost play-by-play account of all the steps that led up to the initial complaint, which fell on deaf ears in April of 1968, and then when the complaint was resumed in the fall-winter of 1968, and all the developments in between which led to the occupation in January. I can say that, you know, I mean, obviously the complaints were made, and I mentioned the context in which they reissued those complaints. Alfie Roberts was one of the people that actually helped draft the initial complaint that was sent to the administration. In fact, I think he did draft it, actually. He still had a very close contact with the students. He had gone to Sir George Williams himself. But by then, by 68, he was working, but kept close contact with many of the students. And he had drafted the initial complaint, and it was pretty much, you know, dismissed out hand and not taken very seriously. And again, I think it was one of those things where not recognizing how that, you know, you weren't just dealing with a group of children. You're dealing with adults, young adults, in some cases even older adults, who, many of whom had worked, these were science students that had filed the complaint, had worked in labs back home, were considered scientists in some form or another back home, but came to further their education. And, you know, they came here and saw science students, I mean science professors and other professors. Alfie described it to me once in terms of, you know, what's this book in his political science class? What is it? Harold Lasswell, Who Gets What, How, and Why, something along those lines. How this was one of the core textbooks of the time for political science. And, you know, pretty straightforward book, basic political science 101, something close to that. The professor will be reading out of the book. So then you have a person like Alfie, you know, seasoned political person, even at his young, precocious age. And, you know, all these ideas, and all these ideas about, you know, what a university is like abroad and so on. And you have the professor, you know, not adding anything to what you're already reading in the book, but more than that is, you know, reading from the text behind his binder, you know. And you know, so they weren't really impressed with that. You know, on top of that, Alfie also complained that, you know, he would get an A throughout most of the year and end up with a C with no logical explanation. So he was not surprised and could sympathize with what happened with these science students who complained about Professor Anderson failing them or giving them lower marks than they deserved. And in fact, many of the students apparently had been told not to take that class if you could avoid it, because it was a poor teacher who seemed to have this penchant for giving lower marks to the West Indian students. But for those who wanted to study medicine, they apparently had to take this course. So there was no getting around it. So, you know, that's, you know, basically the core. That's where this whole thing started in terms of the students filing their complaint. But what I was going to say in terms of the administration is that they failed to realize who these students were. In their mind, they were just a bunch of students from the West Indies who were probably privileged to be here and shouldn't be complaining. They misread the situation completely from the outset, which is very clear in terms of even dismissing the initial complaint without a proper hearing, and fumbled the entire thing up until that point, until it became a crisis. And along the way, they came to recognize that what these students were demanding was more than, you know, a hearing. It was basic respect. And, you know, I think in terms of up until that point, as far as the complaint goes and how the administration dealt with it, that's kind of, you know, the thrust of my understanding of how that developed and what the essence of those issues were, and why also after a certain point, it became more than just these West Indian or black students, and why an entire community became immersed and involved in this thing, and why so many students who may not have been science students, may not have been from the West Indies, and may not have been black, became actively involved in this thing. So even though it was black student-led, the truth of the matter is, in terms of the occupation, when the arrests were tallied, there were actually more white students than there were black. You know, because, you know, again, we see it within the context of everything that was happening in the world, what was happening in Canada, and what was happening in Montreal. You know, so it was one other major important development. But you have to look at it as a student development, yes, but well beyond the student sphere in terms of what was happening in Quebec and Montreal, and what was happening more specifically in the black community in Montreal. So I think all of those things are intertwined.
Can you provide a description of how the students took over the computer center and why they chose to, and what happened when they were in there and how they were removed?
Well, again, because I haven't focused as much on the details over a period of time, like, you know, a broad sketch, yes, in terms of, like, I've actually seen film footage, and I think you might have seen it too, of when the students were talking in the hall building, hall H110, I think it was, and having a kind of public meeting / rally. And I think it followed a kind of, what would you call it? We called it a hearing meeting, where Professor Anderson and several members of the administration were present. But then the students came to the conclusion this was a mock meeting, it wasn't serious, and left that meeting. Now, my chronology may be a bit off here in terms of whether it was on that same day, in that same general period of time, that they actually ended up going up to the home. But at some point, they did go up to the computer room. And as to whether it was predetermined, I think it was, to a certain extent, in the sense that in one of the student newspapers, an article had been written about the vulnerable points in terms of university offices, centers, and the computer center was indicated as one of those vulnerable places that maybe the university need to pay attention to in terms of security. But it's been suggested that that also, you know, brought that possibility to the attention of some of the students too. According to what I was told by Alfie Roberts, Felipe Felisame, who I think was a student at Sir George too, from Haiti originally, and he's one of the those that was eventually arrested. From what I understand, he was the one that made the initial suggestion, look, let's go to the computer room, let's occupy the computer room. He was the one that first thought about organizing an occupation. But then, you know, occupations had also become a way of life across North America. There were major developments at NYU that ended up in bloody circumstances. Other American universities, also at Berkeley, the other side of the, you know, on the West Coast. So the, you know, these developments were part of, you know, there was everyday news, international news. So I mean, a student occupation wasn't something out of the ordinary. In terms of once they had, you know, see, when I talk about like being concerned in some respects about the broad thrust of things, you know, I think recognizing the developments that led up to the occupation, but the whole broad current of events, and like the dynamics within those events and how things evolved into what eventually happened at Sir George, it informs our understanding of social change in many different ways. One of the things that Alfie used to talk about quite a bit, and he actually mentioned it in a very an extended interview I did with him in 1995, was that, you know, looking at how the students organize themselves in the computer room, it helped crystallize in his mind this whole question of organization. They took over the computer room, but computers during that time were not, it was like these big machines all over the place, first of all, and they had to be managed, maintained. And somehow the students, sort of a division of labor was established, where some were responsible for monitoring the computers, some were in charge of public relations inside the computer room, some helped to organize the food, and food was brought in by members of the community and so on. Some watched the door. Alfie was one of the people. I mentioned his role earlier on about preparing the initial complaint. But he was one of the people that was at the door, along with Aduke, Viola Daniels, who was the wife of Omawale, or Kennedy Fredericks, one of the initial complainants. And one of the things that struck him, in addition to that internal self-organization, like people put in a position where they had to organize themselves, and that's what happened. There wasn't one person saying, you do this, you do that. You know, it sort of evolved into this almost natural occurrence in that kind of spirit too. But one of the things that struck him in terms of, you know, and this is like a testament to Alfie's keen insight that allowed him to see, you know, like beyond the immediate in many respects and sort of understand the significance behind something that may just seem simple, is that professors were still coming in and out. This is the level of order that was involved. Were still coming in and out of the computer room for one reason or another, under the supervision of the students. But these professors would have to come and show their identification to this group of people who they didn't know. So they sort of had to succumb to this new form of authority. They had no choice. And they did. And it takes a certain level of vision and insight to extrapolate from that and suggest how, this in its sort of very kind of preliminary micro form is an example how, under the right climate and circumstances, you know, the mentality of people, if it has to, can change. People who may see themselves in position of power today can also, if it's imposed, and I'm saying that perhaps literally and also figuratively, can rethink how a society is structured, or rethink or reassess their understanding of authority. And that was one of the things that Alfie sort of took from this thing. It helped crystallize that whole series of developments that I just described inside the computer room, including like professors and members of the administration succumbing to the authority of these students, having to show them their ID, but also the organization within, which also extended beyond the computer room into the community. All of that was seen as a reflection of how people can organize themselves and manage their affairs. So that was one of the major lessons, and it's also one of the major lessons that I have sort of held close to me in terms of understanding like the evolution of a community. But to take that further, and maybe I'm jumping beyond like some of the details of what actually happened at St. George, but I think those are pretty much there for the record in terms of what happened in the computer room and the occupation, and maybe we can talk a bit about what happened in terms of police, because there are some things that haven't been as much sort of common knowledge, so we can come back to that. But out of this whole broad current of events that started in 65, and you see the evolution of the development of the black population in terms of its confidence and its understanding of community and finding its place in this new society, and also having influence in the North American setting, Canada-wide, in the U.S. to a certain extent, and in the Caribbean. In addition to that, after St. George, St. George was like an explosion. And after that explosion, a number of institutions in terms of, you know, and I alluded to what I think. It's speculation at the moment, but I'm more than convinced that links can be made to this whole multicultural, you know, and other things can be explored in terms of how the impact it had on Canada. But what is certain is that a number of institutions within Montreal and Canada's black community exploded onto the scene, which is also another, you know, in terms of inform, you know, what is this thing called change, you know, what confluence of forces, you know, subjective forces in terms of human, you know, human development and human actions, and there's forces that are out there almost in the air, you can say, which you can't completely explain. We can't explain completely why the 60s was this explosive period in world history, and that, you know, centuries from now people will look back at the 60s and say, wow, you know, what was it about this period? And I don't think there's any, I don't think there's one single answer. But that's the objective part that we can't completely account for. You know, we like to think that we can account for everything in science, and like social scientists like to think, but you can't account for everything. But there was something about the 60s, whatever it was, you know, depending on your beliefs, it could have been cosmic, who knows, but it was something. And what you see is that post-1969, you see a plethora of newspapers, magazines, journals, institutions like the Black Theater Workshop, the Black Study Center, Quebec Black Board of Educators, Black Theater, other Black theater groups, after school programs, summer programs for Black youth, all kinds of bodies and institutions came into being. It's like almost sudden, you know, an explosion. All of these things are just there, as if, you know, they just, you know, like magic. But, you know, it's a, you know, it kind of suggests to us how there are ebbs and flows in history. So there can be a period in history where everything just seems quiet and tranquil, and nothing is happening. So even as they were organizing these conferences, it attracted the attention of some West Indian students. Others dismissed the conference committee members as these Reds. In fact, some of the members of the New World Group said, who are these Reds, you know, talking about C.L.R. James and Marxism and this, that, and the other. But then their organizational work precipitated the Congress of Black Writers, which precipitated, in many respects, Sir George Williams' incident, in terms of the work that the students of the conference committee, well, going back, the work of the conference committee influenced those who laid the complaint, but then when the Congress of Black Writers happened, it re-influenced or had an influence and an impact on those students who launched the complaint earlier, before the Congress had taken place. So all of these things came together, which is a way of saying, like, you don't know what you do today, how, what kind of impact will have tomorrow. But what is certain is if you don't do anything, then nothing happens. Because nothing from nothing is just that, nothing. So these guys had a vision of the world, and they had a vision of the kind of society they wanted to live in. But they couldn't have had any idea how, what kind of impact the work that they did in the mid to late 60s would have on events down the road in Montreal and in the Caribbean. They couldn't have known that. They couldn't have predicted that. So you had all of these institutions that came into being. Many of them still exist today. Some of them, some people may say, have outlived their usefulness and need to evolve, but that's another question. They met a specific need at a very specific time and still continue to meet some of those needs today. Many of those institutions are still around, as I was saying. So that's one of the things that those are among the developments that came out of Sir George. And then internationally, now where do we start? Because in order to talk about the international impact, you have to go back a bit and look at what happened in 68, because after the Congress of Black Writers, Walter Rodney, who'd been participating along with Bobby Hill in these grounding sessions in Jamaica, was banned from Jamaica. He came back to Montreal on the same plane that he flew into Jamaica on. And that led to one of the, still to this day, one of the major, you can call it uprisings or rebellions or riots, that Jamaica has seen, particularly in recent history. which was clamped down upon by the police. It has been suggested that there were also Canadian police, you know. And it's a whole other conversation to talk about Canada's role or relationship to the Caribbean, because I was going to say a strong argument could be made, but it's not even an argument. It's quite clear that if you're talking about economic imperialism in the Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean, you have to talk about Canada before you talk about the United States. Geopolitics is one thing, but if you want to talk about who has historically, particularly this century, last century, controlled the economy of the Caribbean, and then look at his connection to Quebec. And in fact, when Walter Rodney came here in 68, he mentioned that Saguenay, where aluminum foil is manufactured from bauxite that comes from Guyana and Jamaica and so on. He made that connection in his speech here. When you look at the banks that you see throughout the Caribbean, Royal Bank, Bank of Nova Scotia, Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, you know, insurance companies and trust companies, Canadian for the longest while, more so than the British, more so than American, which is quite amazing. But that in some respects is another story, but not completely, because some people were aware of that. Many West Indians, people from the Caribbean, were aware of that. So when Walter was banned, these developments took place in terms of the response by the population, particularly in Kingston. And out of that, a group named Abeng, which included Robert Hill, as I mentioned, also concluded later Trevor Monroe, who formed the Workers' Party of Jamaica, Jamaica's Communist Party, because it's an important benchmark in Canadian history, world history.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dave.
Yeah, you're more than welcome.